This, however, was only the idea. It took 22 more years of sporadic and sometimes desultory activity before the new dictionary truly got off the ground. The Philological Society had already complicated matters. 6 months before Trench's famous speech, it had set up a so-called Unregistered Words Committee, had corralled along with Trench the boisterous Frederick Furnival and Herbert Coleridge, the poet's grandson, to run it, and had planned to devote its corporate efforts to publishing a supplement dictionary of everything not found in the books that had already been published. It took many months for the enthusiasm behind that project to abate, though it was given a nudge by the swift realisation that so many words were being uncovered in searches that any supplement would be far, far bigger than any book, even Johnson's, that was already available. Once that was behind them, the Society formally adopted the idea of a wholly new dictionary. January the 7th, 1858, when the plan was adopted, is normally reckoned the starting point, at least on paper. Frederick Furnival then issued a circular calling for volunteer readers. They could select from which period of history they'd like to read books, from 1250 to 1526, the year of the New English Testament, from then to 1674, the year when Milton died, or from 1674 to what was then the present day. Each period, it was felt, represented the existence of different trends in the development of the language. The volunteers' duties were simple enough, if onerous. They would write to the Society offering their services in reading certain books. They'd be asked to read and make word lists of all that they had read, and would then be asked to look, super specifically, for certain words that currently interested the dictionary team. Each volunteer would take a slip of paper, write at its top left-hand side the target word, and below, also on the left, the date of the details that followed. These were, in order, the title of the book or paper, its volume and page number, and then below that, the full sentence that illustrated the use of the target word. It was a technique that has been undertaken by lexicographers to the present day. Herbert Coleridge became the first editor of what was to be called A New English Dictionary on Historical Principles. He undertook as his first task what may seem prosaic in the extreme, the design of a small stack of oak board pigeonholes, 9 holes wide and 6 high, which could accommodate the anticipated 60,000 to 100,000 slips of paper that would come in from the volunteers. He estimated that the first volume of the dictionary would be available to the world within 2 years. And were it not for the dilatoriness of many contributors, he wrote, clearly in a tetchy mood, I should not hesitate to name an earlier period. Everything about these forecasts was magnificently wrong. In the end, more than 6 million slips of paper came in from the volunteers, and Coleridge's dreamy estimate that it might take 2 years to have the first saleable part of the dictionary off the presses, for it was to be sold in parts to help keep revenues coming in, was wrong by a factor of 10. It was this kind of woefully naive underestimate of work, of time, of money, that at first so hindered the dictionary's advance. No one had a clue what they were up against. They were marching blindfolded through molasses. And Herbert Coleridge's early death slowed matters down even more. He died after only 2 years at work, at the age of 31, not even halfway through looking at the quotations of words beginning with the letter A. He'd been caught in the rain on the way to a Philological Society lecture, and he had sat through it in the unheated upstairs room on St. James's Square and caught a chill and died. His last recorded words were, "I must begin Sanskrit tomorrow." Furnival then took over and threw all of his breezy energy and single-minded determination into his work, but in the same madcap irresponsible manner that had already made him such legions of enemies. He had the bright and enduring idea of hiring a team of sub-editors, whom he'd interposed between the volunteer readers, now gaily sending in their slips of paper with the necessary quotations, and the editor himself. These subs could check the incoming slips for their accuracy and value, then sort them into bundles and place them in the pigeonholes. It would then be up to the editor to decide on the word he was going to do, take out from its place in the alphabetically arranged pigeonholes the bundle of quotations for that target word, and decide which of the quotations best suited his needs. Which one was the earliest, this was vitally important, of course, and which others thereafter demonstrated the slow progress of the word as its meaning varied over the centuries, up to whatever was its primary meaning now. But Furnival presided over a project that, in spite of all his energies and enthusiasm, started slowly, but clearly, to die. For some reason never quite explained, Furnival had not the ginger to keep the hundreds of volunteers enthused, and so, slowly and steadily, they simply stopped reading, stopped sending in the slips. It seemed to many an insurmountable task. Many, in fact, sent back their books and the papers that Furnival had sent them to read. In 1879 alone, they had returned 2 tons of material. The dictionary was well and truly stalled, perhaps a victim of its own massive ambition. Furnival's reports to the Society became shorter and shorter, his sculling expeditions with waitresses from the ABC tea shop longer and longer. In 1868, the Athenaeum, the journal that most closely followed the progress of the work, told its London readers that the general belief is the project will not be carried out. But it did not die. James Murray, it'll be remembered, had been a member of the Philological Society since 1869. He had already made a name for himself with publications on Scottish dialect, with huge editing tasks of Scottish poetry, and with noble but unfinished projects, such as a planned work on the declension of German nouns. He had left the Chartered Bank of India and had resumed his beloved teaching, this time at the distinguished London public school, Mill Hill. Furnival, who, though clearly committed to the dictionary, simply lacked the personal qualities necessary to lead it, thought that Murray would be a perfect choice as editor. He approached Murray, and others of the Society too. Would not this astonishing young man, Murray was then just over 40, not be the ideal candidate? And moreover, would not the Oxford University press, with its academic distinction, comparatively deep pockets and a flexible view of literary time, be the ideal house to publish the work? Murray was persuaded to produce some specimen sheets, suggestions of how the work might look. He chose the words arrow, carouse, castle, and persuade, and in the late autumn of 1877 these pages were duly sent off to Oxford to the press's notoriously difficult delegates, essentially the board of directors, who were infamous for being dauntingly highbrow, irritatingly pedantic, and fiscally mean. Furnival continued to meet other publishers and printers. The House of Macmillan was at one time deeply involved, but backed out after a dispute with Furnival, and he made endlessly certain that the big dictionary remained on everybody's mind. The twin notions of selecting the right editor and the proper publisher continued to vex the lexicographical and commercial literary establishments of England for the final years of the 70s. Oxford's delegates first dismayed everyone by saying that they cared little for Murray's specimen pages. They wanted more proof that Murray had looked hard enough for quotations for his 4 chosen words. They said they didn't like the way he had offered the words' pronunciations, and they dithered about whether or not his etymological section should be omitted, not least because they were already publishing a quite separate and scholarly etymological dictionary of their own. In exasperation, Murray and Furnival looked hopefully towards the Cambridge press, but the syndics there, the local equivalent of the Oxford delegates, offered only a brusque rebuff. Lobbying went on in common rooms and London clubs week after week. And as time passed, so Oxford slowly became persuaded that changes could be made, that the powers that be might ultimately find the pages of the proposed book to be acceptable, that Murray might well be the man, and that the big dictionary could in fact one day have the commercial and intellectual appeal that Oxford wanted. It was finally on April the 26th, 1878, that James Murray was invited up to Oxford for the first meeting with the delegates themselves. He had come expecting to be terrified of them. They imagined they'd be dismissive of him. But to everyone's surprised delight, he found that he rather liked the grand old men who sat in that great Oxford boardroom, and more to the point, they discovered in short order that they very much liked him. The upshot of the meeting was the delegates' decision, in a moment of subdued and characteristically Oxonian jubilation, celebrated with a glass or two of indifferent dry sherry, to proceed. Arguments over the details of the contract, which were often bitter but were rarely conducted in person by a decidedly otherworldly James Murray, though his hard-headed wife Ada did have things to say, took another full year. Finally, on March the 1st, 1879, almost a quarter of a century after the speech by Richard Chenevix Trench, a document was formally agreed upon. James Murray was to edit, on behalf of the Philological Society of London, the New English Dictionary on Historical Principles, which would spread itself across an estimated 7,000 quarto pages in 4 thick volumes and take 10 years to complete. It was still a woeful underestimate, but the work was now beginning properly, and this time it was never to stop. Within days, Murray had made 2 decisions. First, he would build a corrugated iron shed on the grounds of Mill Hill School. He'd call it the Scriptorium, the first of his 2 specially built headquarters, and he would edit the Great Dictionary from there. And second, he would write and have published a 4-page appeal to the English-speaking and English-reading public for a vast, fresh corps of volunteers. The committee, he declared, want help from readers in Great Britain, America, and the British colonies to finish the volunteer work so enthusiastically commenced 20 years ago by reading and extracting the books which still remain unexamined. The 4 sheets of paper, 8 pages of writing, went out to the magazines and newspapers of the day, which regarded them as a press release, and published such parts as seemed likely to interest their readers. They went out also to bookshops and newsstands, and assistants handed them out to customers. Librarians handed them out as bookmarks, and there were small wooden cases in shops and libraries from which the public could take them and read them. Before long, they had found wide circulation all around the United Kingdom and its various dominions, old and new. And, sometime in the early 1880s, 1 copy at least, left inside a book or slipped between the pages of a learned journal, found its way to one of 2 large cells on the top floor of Block 2 of the Broadmoor Asylum for the Criminally Insane in Crowthorne, Berkshire. It was read voraciously by William Minor, a man for whom books, with which one of his 2 cells was lined from floor to ceiling, had become a second life. Dr. Minor had been an inmate at Broadmoor for the previous 8 years. He was deluded, true, but he was a sensitive and intelligent man, a graduate of Yale, and well-read and curious. He was, understandably, preternaturally anxious to have something useful to do, something that might occupy the weeks and months and years and decades that stretched without limit, until Her Majesty's pleasure be known, before him. This invitation from a Dr. James Murray of Mill Hill, Middlesex, N.W., it seemed, promised an opportunity for intellectual stimulus, and perhaps even a measure of personal redemption that was far better than any he could otherwise imagine. He would write immediately. He took down paper and pen, and in a firm hand wrote his address, Broadmoor, Crowthorne, Berkshire. A perfectly ordinary address. To anyone who didn't know any better, it was merely a means of describing an ordinary house in an ordinary village in a prettily rural royal county just beyond the boundaries of London. And even if someone outside did know the word asylum, the sole definition that was available at the time was quite innocent in its explanation. The meaning was to be found in Johnson's dictionary, naturally. A place out of which he that has fled to it may not be taken. An asylum was to Dr. Johnson no more than a sanctuary, a refuge. William Chester Minor was quite content to be seen to write from inside such a place, just so long as no one looked too closely for the deeper and more sinister meaning that the word was then gathering to itself in the hard times of Victorian England. The Scholar in Cell Block 2. Bedlam, noun. The Hospital of St. Mary of Bethlehem, used as an asylum for the reception and cure of mentally deranged persons. Originally situated in Bishopsgate, in 1676 rebuilt near London Wall, and in 1815 transferred to Lambeth, hence Jack or Tom O'Bedlam, a madman. By extension, a lunatic asylum, a madhouse. Minor, William Chester. A thin, pale, and sharp-featured man with light, sandy-coloured hair, deep-set eyes, and prominent cheekbones. He is 38 years old, of superior education, indeed a surgeon, but of no known religion. He weighs 10 stone 1 pound, and is formally classified as being dangerous to others. He was charged with the wilful murder of one George Merritt of Lambeth, was found not guilty on the grounds of insanity. He says he has been the victim of persecution for years, the victim of the lower classes, in whom he has no faith. Persons unknown are trying to injure him with poison. So begin the case notes for Broadmoor patient 742, based on an examination conducted in the afternoon of the day he was admitted, Wednesday, April the 17th, 1872. Guards had brought him there in shackles, along with another murderer, a man who was classified as too insane to be tried, named Edmund Dainty. Both had been waiting in jail in Newington in Surrey until the necessary papers had been brought down from London. The men were brought first by steam train to the small red-brick Gothic railway station that had been built by and then named for Wellington College, one of the great schools of southern England, and which stood nearby. A black Broadmoor landau, its roof closed, then took Minor and his escorts through the narrow leafy lanes winding around the tiny village. The horses were sweating slightly as they hauled the four-wheel vehicle and its occupants up the low sandstone hill, at the top of which stands Broadmoor itself. The special hospital, as it's called today, still looks a forbidding place, even though much of what must have rendered it quite terrifying in Victorian times is now hidden discreetly behind its high, smoothly round-topped, modern maximum security walls. In 1872, Dr. Minor came to the original front gate, two triple-storied towers with heavily barred windows, with an imposing archway between, topped by a large black-faced clock. The arch was closed by a massive pair of green outer wooden doors. A peephole in one snapped open at the sound of the horse's hooves. The doors swung back to reveal another set of heavy gates, 10 yards deeper, into the asylum. The landau moved swiftly inside, the front doors were slammed closed and bolted hard, and the lights in the dim and cavernous reception area were switched on. Dr. Minor was ordered to step out to be searched. His chains were removed to be taken back to Surrey. The escorting tipstaff, the Broadmoor bailiff, handed over the papers, a long warrant in elegant copperplate above the signature of Henry Austin Bruce, Her Majesty's Principal Secretary of State for the Home Department. The asylum superintendent, a kindly and sympathetic man named William Orange, had his deputy sign the receipt. Dr. Minor was led through the second set of gates and into Block 4, the admissions building. He heard the horses turn around, heard his escort clamber up into the carriage and order the driver to return to the railway station. He heard the outer gates open to let the carriage out and then close again. There was a resounding second crash as the inner metal gates shut and were bolted and chained. He was now formally and properly a Broadmoor inmate, confined in what would probably be his home for the rest of his natural life. It was a fairly new home, however. Broadmoor had been open just 9 years. It had been built because the state's main lunatic asylum, the Hospital of St. Mary of Bethlehem, from which we have the word bedlam for madhouse, was now full to bursting. By coincidence, it was located in Lambeth, actually, less than a mile from the murder site. Legal recognition of criminal madness had been established by Parliament in 1800, and judges had for the past half-century been dispatching into asylums, and sentencing to stay there until the monarch's pleasure be known, scores of men and women who would hitherto have been sent to ordinary prisons. The Victorians, with their characteristic mix of severity and enlightenment, believed the inmates could both be kept securely away from the public to whom they were so dangerous, and properly treated. But the Enlightenment only went so far, while nowadays the Broadmoor inmates are patients, and Broadmoor itself a special hospital, a century ago there was no mincing of words. The inmates were lunatics and criminals. They were treated by alienists and mad doctors, and Broadmoor was indubitably an asylum in which they were firmly imprisoned. Broadmoor certainly looked and felt, and was meant to look and feel, like a prison. It had been designed by a military architect, Sir Joshua Jebb, who had previously created two of England's darkest high-security penitentiaries, Pentonville and Dartmoor. It had long, gaunt cell blocks, severe and intimidating. All the buildings were of dark red brick. All the windows were barred. There was a huge wall topped with iron spikes and broken glass. The institution slouched, crab-like, ugly and forbidding on the top of its hill. Villagers would look upward towards it and shudder. They tested the escape sirens every Monday morning. The banshee wails that echoed and re-echoed across the hills were spine-chilling. People said the birds remained silent, frightened, for many minutes afterwards. But Dr. Minor, an American murderer, where to put him? The normal practice, which, to judge from his case notes, was almost certainly followed in Miner's case, was to spend several early days asking the newcomer about himself, and then, if he wanted to discuss it, about the crime that had caused him to be sent there. One newcomer, asked why he had killed his wife and children, told the superintendent, "I don't know why I'm telling you all of this. It's none of your business. As a matter of fact, it was none of the judge's business either. It was a purely family affair." Once that was duly accomplished, it was then standard Broadmoor practice never again to ask about the crime, the superintendent decided which of the six male blocks, there were two others for women, securely fenced off from the men, of course, was most suitable. If the patient was judged suicidal, and his records were thereafter written on pink cards, not white, he was put in a cell in block six, where there were extra staff members to observe him all the time. If he was diagnosed epileptic, he was put in another cell in the same block, a special cell that had padded walls and a wedge-shaped pillow on which he couldn't suffocate himself during a fit. If he was thought to be dangerous and violent, he was also shut up in block six, or maybe the slightly smaller staffed block one, the two being known variously as the strong blocks, the disturbed blocks, or more recently, the refractory blocks. Then, as now, these two buildings, grimmer and gaunter than the rest, were known among the inmates as the back blocks, because they have no view over the landscape. They are secure, tough, miserable. After the first few days of interrogations, the Broadmoor doctors realized that their new charge, a doctor himself, after all, was neither epileptic, nor liable to kill himself, nor sufficiently violent to do anyone else an injury. So he was sent to Block 2, a relatively comfortable wing that was usually kept for parole patients. It was called the Swell Block, the word used in the British sense meaning it tended to be occupied by swells. A visitor once wrote that Block 2 had an atmosphere described by someone familiar with both as identical with that at the Athenaeum Club. It's difficult to imagine that too many members of this most genteel of London's gentlemen's clubs, which included on its rolls most of the bishops and learned men of the land, were thrilled by the comparison. Yet Miner was made more than just tolerably comfortable, not least because he was a well-born, well-educated man. And he had an income. All the Broadmoor officials knew that he was a retired soldier with a regular army pension paid from the United States. So he was given not one cell, but two, a pair of connecting rooms at the south end of the block's top floor. The rooms were kept unlocked by day. At night, any medicines and food he might need were handed in through a long vertical slot, too narrow for an arm to reach out, with a lockable door on the outer side. The windows had iron bars on the inside, but to compensate there was an enchanting view, a long, shallow valley of cattle-filled meadows with the cows standing in the shadow of great oak trees, the Broadmoor tennis courts and a small cricket ground to one side, a line of low blue hills crowned with beeches in the distance. On that early spring day, with clear skies and lilacs and apple blossom, and the song of larks and thrushes, perhaps the sentence may not have seemed altogether a nightmare. At the north end of the corridor sat the guard, known at the asylum as an attendant, who kept watch over the 20 men on his floor. He had keys, presided over the ever-locked door to the floor itself, and he'd let the inmates in and out of their rooms to visit the bathroom. And during the day he kept a small gas flame burning from a brass jet beside him. The men were not allowed matches. This is where they came to light their cigarettes or their pipes, from the tobacco ration they were handed each week. The tobacco all came from the HM Customs Service. Anything confiscated as contraband at the ports was handed over to the Home Office for distribution at the prisons and the state lunatic asylums. Within days, the American Vice Consul was writing, making sure that the hapless army officer was being well looked after. Might it be possible for our poor friend, he prayed, to have some of his personal effects sent down? They'd been left at the consulate to help pay any of the diplomat's expenses at court. Is it in theory possible to visit? To cheer him up, could we send him a pound of Dennis's coffee and some French plums? Mr. Orange was silent on the specific matter of plums, but told the consul that Dr. Miner could have whatever he liked so long as it didn't prejudice his safety or the asylum's disciplined running. So a week later the official sent up a leather portmanteau by rail. It held a frock coat and three waistcoats, 3 pairs of drawers and 4 undervests, 4 shirts, 4 collars, 6 pocket handkerchiefs, a prayer book, a box of photographs, 4 pipes, cigarette papers, a bag of tobacco, a map of London, a diary, and a fob watch and a gold chain, the last a family heirloom, it had been said during the trial. Most important of all, the superintendent reported later, the doctor was given back his drawing materials. A cheap deal drawing box and its contents, a paint box, and a collection of pens, a drawing board, sketchbook, and painting cards. He'd now be able to occupy his time constructively, which all patients were encouraged to do. Over the succeeding months, Minor furnished his cells comfortably, much indeed as a member of the Athenaeum might. He had money. His officer's pension of about $1,200 a year was paid to his brother Alfred in Connecticut. He acted for William, whom the state had designated an incapable person, who regularly telegraphed funds to England to keep his sick brother's running account up to date. Using this constant credit, Dr. Minor satiated his one consuming passion, books. He demanded first that his own books be sent over from home in New Haven. Once they were installed, he ordered from the big London bookstores scores upon scores of new and second-hand volumes, which he first stacked in precarious piles in his cells until he asked, and paid for, bookshelves to be built. In the end, he had converted the more westerly of the two rooms into a library, with a writing desk, a couple of chairs, and floor-to-ceiling teak bookshelves. He kept his easel and his paints in the other easterly room. He also kept a small selection of wines and some bourbon, with which the consul kept him supplied. He took up the flute again and gave lessons to some of his neighbour inmates. He also found that he was permitted and was well able to afford to pay one of his fellow patients to perform work for him, tidying his room, sorting his books, cleaning up after a painting session. Life, which in those first months had been at least tolerable, now started to become really quite agreeable. William Minor was able to live a life of total leisure and security. He was warm and reasonably well fed. His health was attended to. He could stroll along the long gravel pathway known as the terrace. He could take his ease on one of the benches by the lawn and gaze at the shrubbery. Or he could read and paint to his heart's content. His cells still exist. Not much at Broadmoor has changed in a century, and although Block 2 is now called Essex House, it's still much preferred for those patients who are in for the long haul. One of the two rooms, the westerly of the pair, where Dr. Minor maintained his library, houses a patient whose violent propensities are readily apparent. The room is littered with magazines devoted to bodybuilding. Posters on the walls celebrate the achievements of Rambo-like figures. There are technical drawings of large American motorcycles, and a slogan torn from a comic book has been pasted onto the cell door. It says, "Mad Killer." The other room, where Minor painted, was by contrast so tidy that it looked almost unoccupied. The bed was so well made that one could have bounced the proverbial coin on its taut surface. Leather shoes were neatly arranged and polished. Clothes were hanging neatly in the wardrobe. There were no books, nothing on the walls. The fireplace had long since been boarded up, although there was a mantel, which had a small desk calendar. The room's occupant, I was told, was an Egyptian. Dr. Minor's sanity, or lack thereof, was never in doubt. He was never so ill as to be ordered away from the benign atmosphere of Block 2 and into the harsher regime of the back blocks, although a strange and terrible incident in 1902 did take him away from his rooms for many weeks. But the ward notes show that his delusions became over the years ever more fixed, ever more bizarre, and that there seemed no likelihood that he would ever regain his reasoning. He was comfortable in Broadmoor, maybe, but there was nowhere else that he could be allowed to live. The ward notes from his first 10 years show the sad and relentless progress of his downward spiral. Already at the time he was admitted, he had a detailed awareness of the curious happenings that plagued him at night, always at night. Small boys, he believed, were put up in the rafters above his bed. They came down when he was fast asleep, chloroformed him, and then forced him to perform indecent acts, though whether with them as boys or whether with the women of whom he dreamed constantly, the record keepers were never clear. He claimed he would awake with abrasions around his nose and mouth where they had clamped the gas bottle. The bottoms of his pajama legs were always damp, he said, indicating he had been forced to walk in a stupor through the night. April 1873, Dr. Minor is thin and anemic, excitable in manner, though appears rational by day, and occupies himself with painting and playing the flute. but at night he barricades the door of his room with furniture and connects the handle of the door with the furniture using a piece of string so that he will awaken if anyone tries to enter the bedroom. June 1875. The doctor is convinced that intruders managed to get in from under the floor or through the windows and that they pour poison into his mouth through a funnel. He now insists on being weighed each morning to see if the poisoning has made him heavier. August 1875. The expression of his face in the morning is often haggard and wild, as though he did not obtain much rest. He complains that he feels as if a cold iron has been pressed against his teeth at night, and that something is being pumped into him. Otherwise, no change. A year later, the demons were seeming to have a depressing influence. In February 1876, the doctors noted, "A fellow patient stated today that Dr. Minor came to see him in the boot room and said he would give him everything if only he would cut his, Dr. Minor's, throat. An attendant was ordered to look after him." The following year was no better. Socially, he was reported as explaining to an attendant in May 1877, "All systems are based on schemes of corruption and knavery, and he is the subject of their machinations. This lies at the heart of the brutal torture to which he is subjected each night. His spinal marrow is pierced, and his heart is operated on with instruments of torture. His assailants come up through the floor." In 1878, technology becomes a part of the villainy. Electric currents from unseen sources, the report said, are passed through his body. Electric buttons are placed on his forehead. He's placed in a wagon and trundled across the countryside. "He was taken as far afield as Constantinople," he told an attendant once, "where he is made to perform lewd acts in public. They are," he declared, "trying to make a pimp of me." But while the delusions clearly persisted and worsened over those early asylum years, the clinical notes do show, and crucially to this story, the parallel development of a more thoughtful and scholarly side to the afflicted man. "With the exception of his impressions on the subject of his nighttime visitations," says one entry in the late 1870s, "he talks very coherently and intelligently on most topics. He works in his bit of garden and is fairly cheerful just now, but he has his days of moodiness and reserve." A year later, a doctor records simply, "He is rational and intelligent for the most part." He also begins to settle down, starting to regard the great hospital as his home and the attendants as his family. "He's not particularly aware that he's anxious to go back to America, as at one time he was," writes another doctor. "All he asks is a little bit more freedom, perhaps to go and see sights in London, or perhaps visit the orchid show for which he's just received a card." Yet the doctor who conducted this particular interview was certain of his patient's condition, and inscribed a sentence which seems in hindsight almost to have sealed William Minor's eternal fate. "There can be no doubt that Dr. Minor, though on occasion very calm and collected, is generally speaking more abundantly insane, and shows himself to be more so than he was some years ago. He has the calm and firm conviction that he's almost nightly the victim of torment and purposive annoyance on the parts of the attendants and others connected with an infernal criminal scheme." It was at about this time there came two developments, one of which by chance led indirectly to the other. The first stemmed from a factor that's not uncommon among those who commit appalling crimes. Minor became truly remorseful for what he had done and resolved to try and make some kind of amends. It was with this in mind that he took the bold step of writing to his victim's widow via the American embassy, which he knew had helped raise a fund for her in the months immediately following the tragedy. He explained to Eliza Merritt how immeasurably sorry he was for what he had done, and he offered to try and help her in any way he could, perhaps by settling money on her or her children. Already, Minor's stepmother, Judith, had contributed. Now, perhaps, and if Mrs. Merritt would only be so gracious as to accept, he could do rather more. The letter seems to have worked a small miracle. Not only did Mrs. Merritt agree to accept financial help from Minor, she also asked if it might be possible to visit him. It was an unprecedented request that an incarcerated murderer be allowed to spend time with the relative of his victim. But the Home Office, after discussing the matter with Dr. Orange, agreed to one experimental supervised visit. Accordingly, sometime during late 1879, Mrs. Eliza Merritt travelled up from Lambeth to Broadmoor, and first met the man who had ended her husband's life 7 years before, and who had so drastically changed her own life and the lives of her seven children. The meeting, according to Dr. Orange's notes, was at first tense, but it progressed well, and by its end Mrs. Merritt had agreed to come again. Before long she was making monthly ventures down to Crowthorne, eager to talk with interested sympathy to this now seemingly harmless American. And though the conversations apparently stopped short of developing into any real friendship, it is believed that she made Minor an offer that was to lead to the second of the major developments of this period of his life. She agreed, it seems, to bring parcels of books to Minor from the antiquarian dealers in London.